Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast. I'm Christophe Mallet and I'm your host. And today we have someone a little bit special to us. He's not El Grandissimo Dave McKenzie, but he's big enough in our heart as well. He's Matthew Kinnon. How are you, Kinnon?
I'm good. I've stepped off the bench. Macca and his wife Susan, they're busy riding across Vietnam and I'm jealously following their progress across the countryside.
I know, it's amazing. Eh? The sight and also the avoidance of the car, the traffic, the food, the drinks. He's living his best life, Micah.
He is. The food's got my attention. What was interesting was hearing Susan talk about the traffic over there and that there's more traffic and it looks chaotic from the outside, but she actually feels safer on the road. I found that really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. She compared it with Melbourne as well, which is also one of the safest city on your bike as well. So that says it all. You know, that says
that, or, sure.
If not all, it says a lot anyway. Okay, let's talk about cycling. There's a lot to cover. We'll start, first of all, with what happened the week before. Michael Matthews was this close from winning his monument, his time at the Milan San Remo, but what a win by Philipsen. You called up that race, of course. How was it for you?
It's a long race, and I really like Mads Pedersen's honesty in some of his pre-race interviews, and he said quite openly over the last few years he didn't want to ride it. He found it a boring race. And also another former winner of the race, Maciej Mohoric, he spoke before it the day before at the press conference, and he said it's the only monument where you can have any moment to relax. The first 30, 40 Ks until the breakaway gets established, there's some tension there. Then the breakaway gets established, then you're settled into your rhythm, and you know that as you're approaching the climbs inside the last 50, 60 kilometres, then you've got to switch on. I thought this was one of the best additions.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, it was really, really good. The weather helped, slight tailwind, fastest ever time that we've seen. And there was some real dynamics and great strategy over the last 30 Ks, particularly with the final two climbs.
Yeah, let's talk about this because we've got, okay, Philipsen as a winner.
Yeah.
But let's not disregard the work Mathieu van der Poel did way before in the climbs where he, I'm not going to say he sacrificed himself, but he understood the team orders.
No, he absolutely sacrificed himself. He's the world champion. He's the defending champion. And yeah, he made the call. And Philipsen, I thought it was really brave of Philipsen. Can you imagine sticking your hand up in the team meeting and on the road with 20, 30 Ks to go and say, hey, I'm rainbow good. Jersey, white shorts, work for me. If the pod goes, don't work with him. And when Tadej attacked on the Poggio, Van der Poel was the only one that could genuinely respond to him on the way up. He could have worked with him. He could have made that decision to work with him. And you would think under normal circumstances that Van der Poel would beat Pogacar in a sprint finish if they worked evenly together to the end of it. So he made a really big call and a really mature call. And it shows his leadership status within the team that he can say, the team's bigger than me. I'm going to take the risk. And I'm not going to work with Tadej, and I'm going to work for Jasper Philipsen. And then look at the other side of the coin. How's the pressure on Philipsen in that sprint?
Yeah.
You've got Mads Pedersen in the group. Michael Matthews, who prior to that had been twice third in Milan San Remo, he's now got a second place finish. You got the Pog. You got Pidcock. You got Alaphilippe, a former winner. And Philipsen is saying, hey, defending champion, world champion, your mind today worked for me.
Yeah,
I think
that
is a massive call. It says a lot about Philipsen.
Also, days after, we've learned that Van der Poel signed again for another 5 years for the team. We know Philipsen is yet to sign anywhere. He's end of contract at the end of the year. But it just shows his heart at the minute was with the outfit, the Alpecin. But basically put the ink on the paper for 5 years. So he's delivered on the road and he's delivering in the boardroom, in the contract room.
And he's done a 10-year deal with Canyon Bikes
as well.
Yeah, I
saw that as well.
So, and if you're a bike brand, there's two riders. If I could choose between two riders and you could only, you know, pick one rider as opposed to a team, you're going Van der Poel or Voss.
Yeah.
Because they race it, or Pidcock. Because they race across all the disciplines. So you can do one advertising campaign for the whole range of your bike.
You just change the green screen. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Perfect.
Yeah. Okay, we'll diverge just slightly from cycling, but Mathieu van der Poel was scoring a mullet. Who wears it better, him or Valtteri Bottas? That's a big question at the moment.
Mitch Docker,
exactly. Yeah, I'm actually afraid that the mullet is not going back. He's actually back now, right now.
No, Orban, did you not love the ad with Andre Agassi and the mullet?
Yeah,
the tennis? I mean, that was awesome. That was one of the best mullets of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's talk about Philipsen just for a sec as well. We mentioned that he's out of a contract at the end of the year. Well, he's probably not out of options.
Yeah.
There's so many options from he's hot. He's hot. He's feeling good. What do you think he should do? Should he stay where he is?
Stay. Absolutely stay. I think the only negotiation that he needs to talk about is how big the figure is. And okay. the figure is going to be big, real big. He knows that the team trusts him. If the team didn't trust him, if they didn't back him, they wouldn't have supported his call to get Vanderpool to work for him at Milan-San Remo. Cast your mind back 3 years to the Tour de France when he and Tim Merlier were dual sprinters on Alpecin at the Tour de France. Merlier won the first of the sprints, actually won the stage. And from that moment on, they had Tim Merlier leading out Philipsen, and Philipsen didn't win. And they backed... Between those two, they backed Philipsen and they let Tim Merlier go. And at that moment in time, Tim Merlier was a better sprinter than Jasper Philipsen. But they let Tim Merlier go and he went off to Soudal Quickstep and they kept Philipsen. And then Philipsen had so many near misses, so many second place finishes. And famously, he was second on the stage that Cavendish won that equaled the record of Merckx, the 34th victory. Yeah, yeah. And then he was asked the question, I love this about Philipsen. He was asked the question after finishing second, do you feel like you're an important part of history, finishing second on the day that Mark Cavendish equals the record of Eddie Merckx? He said, no, I didn't want to finish second. I wanted to win. So I wasn't worried about that. And then he's come back and he was the best sprinter without question last year and he won the green jersey. And then we've just seen in the last 24 hours or so in the Dipana, Bruges Dipana, he's gone head-to-head with Tim Merlier. Merlier boxed him in. And then we saw Philipsen push his way out. Philipsen won, and he won convincingly. And we saw Merlier go across the finish line, and he was remonstrating. But I didn't think he had anything to complain about. And we heard all the talk or the chatter after Milan-San Remo about the love fest. Because Philipsen and the Pog, they get along super well. They turn pro together at UAE. Matthews and Tadej Pogacar clearly get along well.
They drove from Monaco to the start of the race
and
together.
And Tadej's car is in Matthews' garage a few times when the house has been under repair. So those three guys get along really well. And they've got a great relationship. Fierce rivals, but once they're across the finish line, they're friends again. Not the case with Philipsen and Merlier.
I like
seeing the combination of both. I love the sportsmanship in the same way that I loved the battles between Federer and Nadal because of you knew they were 100%, but there was a great bond afterwards. But you also like the flip side of a little bit of tension sometimes is good as well. So you can show the role model of how to and how not to your kids.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So between the line, if I'm reading you, disregarding Lance Armstrong's latest comments and latest grab for attention.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And you know, to say the racing was better back then, I disagree. I think the racing's never been better than what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, okay, I think that's absolutely a given. Yeah.
And that is disregarding anything that they were doing back in that time that was turbocharged. The way they're racing now, and the thing that is more impressive now is actually the depth. And that's the biggest change is there was a stage in Paris-Nice where Ineos, they were on the front. I think they forgot that Luke Plapp had left the team and gone to Jacob Alula, but they were on the front. They had the race strung out on this Category 2 climb, and it was in single file for around about 100 riders, maybe even more. Maybe there were still 110, 120 in the group. 10, 15 years ago, at that tempo, up a climb like that, there would have been 50, maybe 40 riders in the group. The gap between the top guys is still the top guys, and we've seen it in the women's peloton as well. The top riders are still the top riders, but the gap between the front of the peloton and the back of the peloton is getting smaller.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, this week it's pretty much all about Volta a Catalunya, I should say. What a race. It's on SBS as well, but what a race and what a pog fest. Can we define it differently?
Well, he hasn't had it all his own way because of the Queen. Nick Schultz. The win by Nick Schultz on
stage good.
One was great. I loved seeing Nick Schultz
so
win.
Close as well, but it turned out our way this time.
Yeah, it did. And he has got such a great relationship with Spain. He speaks fluent Spanish, Nick Schultz. He speaks fluent French as well because he spent his amateur days riding with the French team. He spent some time with the Belgian team. He joined Cajaral. That was where he made his debut in the pro peloton. And then when he was with the Jacob Alula team, he always wanted to share a room when he was on a tour with one of the Spanish guys, which I really loved, so as he could practice his Spanish. So for him to win in the Vuelta a Catalunya is a really nice victory. Yeah. And to pin that result sheet on your record, Schultz first, Pogacar second.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You'd sign up for that.
Especially when you know that Pogacar went on and pretty much win.
Oh, he's won the following two stages. He's dominating the general classification. It's a race for second place overall.
Yeah. What can we say about Sepp Kuss in this race? Let's talk about him because last big race he's won is, of course, the Vuelta.
Yeah.
He's the reigning champion of Spain, I should say, on their Grand Tour. We remember how it was made and how it was done and how he grabbed that victory from the arms of his teammates.
Yeah.
But how do you rate his performance? He's doing well at the minute, but he's doing well in Spain.
Yeah, but he's done well everywhere throughout his career. You look at his performances last year at the Tour and at the Giro, and he is Mr. Reliable, there's no question. And like Nick Schultz, he's got an amazing relationship with Spain. You know, he speaks fluent Spanish as well. And that stage victory that he had at the Tour de France in Andorra, he can see the finish line from his window of his house. So he's got a great relationship with Spain. As for where he's at the moment, I think he's in eighth place or so on the GC at Catalunya, around about 3 minutes or so behind Tadej. That's around about where he belongs at this point in the season. He is not the super talent that Pogacar or Vingegaard are, but he's an incredibly hard worker. And he's benefited at the Vuelta last year by being Plan C. You know, there's real benefit to being the one that gets under the radar when there's a big focus on Vingegaard or Roglic, as it was last year at the Vuelta. The challenge for Kuss is going to be, how's he go when the whole team's built around him? And we spoke about this in commentary as well at Milan-San Remo with Christophe Laporte. Laporte is fantastic, and he has stepped up enormously since joining Visma-Lisa Bike, leaving the Cofidis team. That's where he's had all of his World Tour wins. But you look at most of his wins, and the high-quality wins, most of them, not all, but most of them, have been when, well, Van Aert has been on the team with him, and the focus has been on Wout. So there's a little less pressure on Laporte before the race gets underway, and the rest of the peloton's focusing on the number one guy within the team, and Laporte can benefit from that. He'd struggled at Milan-San Remo, didn't have a great day. I was asking the question, how does he go when he is the number one leader, when the team meeting on the bus is built around him? And the same question mark hangs over the head of Sepp Kuss. Can he be the leader of the team to win a Grand Tour when he goes in as the outright leader? Maybe. But I really think he benefited a lot from having those two other guys with him at the Vuelta last year.
Yeah, and so you think him staying at Visma-Lisa Bike was the right thing to do?
100%. Absolutely the right thing for him to do. Yeah, and for career satisfaction, and the guy's a Grand Tour winner.
I know.
It's amazing. His record is incredible. What he has done in the sport is a significant career already.
In the era we are in as well. When we look back in a couple of decades, era is loaded with champions.
Oh, this is a crazy generation. And there's some massive talents still coming through that haven't completely flourished yet. Juan Ayuso and Carlos Rodriguez, the two young Spaniards, are the ones that come to mind. And, you know, you look at the start list that he managed to beat at the Vuelta last year. He benefited, as I said before, of being on that team, but he didn't fall into the red jersey. He took some risks as well. He put himself out there.
I was there.
Yeah, it was a fantastic race. And I love the way he goes about it. And from the generation from when I fell in love with cycling, I've always compared him to Andy Hampson. And Andy Hampson won a Giro d'Italia, the famous one in the snow in 88. Never quite made it to the podium at the Tour, but I think from memory, Andy Hampson finished fourth in the Tour de France, won a white jersey. White jersey is obviously behind Sepp Kuss with age now. But I see him as really similar to Andy Hampson in terms of the quality of the rider he is. And he's one of the best of his generation, there's no doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got always a little French question when it comes to this podcast. Lenny Martinez, doing well at Canada. What do you? He's still very fresh. He's still very new. Last year, he's done brilliantly at the Vuelta, wore the red jersey for a little while. What do you read on him?
Oh, he's really Spanish, isn't he? That's where his grandfather was born.
No, I'll take it.
I mean, he comes from incredible cycling heritage. With his father was multiple World Cup winner and world champion on mountain biking, Kedel Evans's greatest rival on the dirt. His grandfather won the King of the Mountains classification at the Tour de France. And he is pint size. And he had a stint in the leader's jersey at the Vuelta last year. Is he still only 20?
Yeah,
he's still only 20 years of age. His biggest challenge is going to be time trialing in Grand Tours. He can absolutely challenge for a race like the Vuelta with limited time trialing kilometres and steep, punchy climbs that really suit him. I'm interested to see how he goes when he eventually makes his debut in the Tour de France with the climbs in the Alps. I think the climbs in the Pyrenees will suit him better.
Yeah, but they're very different. We know.
They're very different, and they're almost like some of them, because they're going up to big ski resorts, they're quite big roads, and they're quite consistent roads, and it's the climbs that suit a Geraint Thomas or a Luke Plapp.
You've got nowhere to hide. You've got nowhere to hide.
Whereas those, the changes in the gradients, the rougher road surfaces, the punchiness of the Pyrenees suit him more. So I think long-term, the Vuelta a España is going to suit him, but he's really exciting, and I love watching him race. And again, like most of the riders in this generation, he's a risk-taker.
Should he stay in a French team? Because there's always this discussion with Maca, French riders in a French team, sort of almost plays against, could play against them.
Yeah, you can become complacent in the same way that some of the Aussies don't fit, or they don't get the best out of themselves at Jayco Alula. And I look at Alex Edmondson as an example of that. So Alex Edmondson, he came through the track program, so he spent a lot of time riding the team's pursuit, etc., on the track, you know, going to Olympics and World Championships. So he's always been in a familiar cultural environment. And then onto the road, I don't believe he really fulfilled his potential when he was with the Jayco Alula team and, you know, various different sponsor names. But now that he's gone to DSM, he's in a slightly different culture. He's still got a strong Australian influence there with Luke Roberts as one of the key sports directors, but he's flourishing in that change of environment. And in the same way as I look at Luke Plapp joining Jayco Alula, the culture in the team really suits him. And I believe that team is going to get the best out of Luke Plapp.
Yeah.
But I don't think that team would get the best out of Ben O'Connor. Although Ben O'Connor is an Aussie, I don't believe that that Australian team is the best environment for him. He's coming up to the end of his contract this year.
There's a big debate about where should he go.
I think he should go to Lidl Trek.
Mm-hmm.
And for now, I think Lenny Martinez should stay at Groupama FDJ. Because Thibaut Pinot has retired, they've got David Goudou, which they're holding their hopes on for the general classification. And they've had a lot of experience with Goudou, who's finished fourth at the Tour. Disappointed last year, but he was good the year before. So Martinez, for now, stay there. Long term, it might not be the best option.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of debate around this. Okay, let's talk, before we talk about Gent-Wevelgem coming up this weekend, let's talk about a question I had for you. Where is Wout? Where is Wout at the minute? Has he got pressure to perform in the next few months?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, others have performed already. And where's Wout?
Wout's always got pressure to perform. And he's adding to that pressure, by the way, selecting his race program. But I like it. Why not?
Yeah.
He's done so much already within the sport. And the monuments are the ones that are eluding him. Yeah, he has won Milan-San Remo.
So monuments for him are his Grand Tours. He needs to be, you know, so performance over the next few years to be achieving what he wants in a career. It's in the monuments.
It has to be. And for him, it's Flanders and Roubaix. They're the two races. And we always talk about the rivalry between him and Mathieu van der Poel. At the moment, van der Poel is ahead of him.
Yeah, he's won Roubaix.
He's won Flanders, he's won Roubaix, he's won Milan-San Remo. So he's won three monuments, and Van Aert has won one. And in cyclocross, Van der Poel has been the dominant figure between those two there across the journey of their career. Wout has probably done slightly more at the Tour maybe, but then we've got Van der Poel's worn the yellow jersey at the Tour, and Wout, you know, he's done the green jersey thing and he does an amazing teamwork. So he's made a big call this year by not riding Milan-San Remo, by not riding Paris-Nice or Torino-Adriatico. He's gone to altitude camp to focus on being ready for Flanders and Roubaix.
That's what I meant. The choice were quite strategical this year on which races he's picked. So the pressure is on because he's put pretty much all his eggs in one basket.
Yeah, but why not? I think it does add to the pressure, but I like it. And if it doesn't work, well, it was worth trying something different, because doing the same thing each year hasn't quite worked for him in the last couple of years. And he's absolutely good enough to win those races. We know he is. So he has to just tweak things a little bit. And if you're not moving forward, you're going backwards. You've got to keep evolving, and he is doing that. And we've seen it as well with Maciej Mohoric. So Mohoric rode a couple of races early in Spain, and then he chose not to do Torino or Paris-Nice either. He went to altitude camp in preparation for Milan-San Remo and now the big spring classics in Belgium and France.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's talk about Gent-Wevelgem happening this weekend. First of all, the women's race. Lotte Kopecky is riding Gent-Wevelgem. Anyone can beat her?
Yeah, her teammate, Lorena Rivas.
Yeah.
Who are they going to? Yeah. Balsamo as well, and Longo Borghini. The main rival to SD Works is the Lead Out Trek team. And one of the weaknesses is having a team that is so dominant. And in the women's peloton, it's been SD Works for the last few years. It's who can beat them. In the same way, as brilliant as it was to see Jumbo-Visma, as they were last year, dominate all three Grand Tours, and it was a historical moment, we like to see more rivalry and the stronger riders separated across different teams. Capecchi is, without question, the big favourite. But for her, is she all in at Gent-Wevelgem the same way she will be the following weekend at Tour of Flanders?
Yeah,
Tour of Flanders is the one for her. There's no question about that. And she's the best bike rider on the planet at the moment in the women's peloton for sure, because she can win on any terrain, and she finished second overall in the Tour last year.
Yeah.
Her ride up the Tourmalet, when I first saw her in action, got the chance to commentate on her, we had her with the green highlighter pen over her name all the time. Because this is a woman that's been a world champion on the track and the Madison. She's a fast finisher. She was the number one, number two sprinter in the world for a while, and now she's one of the best climbers as well. She's so good to watch race.
How much experience did she gain in wearing that yellow, do you think, last year?
A lot. And it will also... We spoke before about the contracts at Alpes Inter-Kuning.
Yeah, yeah.
What about the contracts at SD Works?
Well, we know that there's a lot of rumour.
Yeah, so she signed up long-term, Capecchi, and Vollering's not.
And there's rumours around Vollering about that elusive million-dollar contract.
And she deserves the million-dollar contract. Yeah. 100% she does. And she's not the only one that deserves it, but she absolutely deserves it. And I hope she gets it, because it will be like the Greg LeMond moment in the men's peloton. Because, back in the 1980s, they were racing for pennies, essentially, and then LeMond came in with an American professional sports approach, and that changed the dynamic of contract
negotiation. He made a French guy that has an American mindset as well, that Bill de la Vicler, Bernard Tapie.
Correct.
And that when money started flowing in a sport.
Yeah, and LeMond got a $1 million contract, and Bernard Hinault didn't.
Yeah, I know. Believe me, I know.
Yeah. So what happens to the contract negotiations then if Vollering does get this $1 million contract? It raises the bar for everybody. Lift the level of the water and all the boats will rise. Let's hope that happens. And I really hope she leaves SD Works.
Do you?
Absolutely, I do.
Where to, though?
Where should she go? She can go wherever she wants.
Yeah, but where should she go?
Where should she go? Well, I don't want her to go to Lead-Out Trek because they're already super strong. UAE could invest a lot of money. They'd have to build a team around her.
AG Insurance?
Sudan? AG Insurance. I hope not.
Being the Wolfpack sort of part of it, could she be the gel?
Yeah, the reason I hope not is because Sarah Gigante's there, and I want her to stay there as the rider that they start to build that team around. And Sarah Gigante is one of the riders that I'm most excited about watching. She can win the final stage of the Tour de France this year, which finishes it up Alpe d'Huez. She will struggle big time the first few days in the Netherlands. She doesn't need to get more power, Sarah Gigante. She doesn't need to improve her climbing. She just needs to learn to ride position better in the crosswinds, etc. That's her biggest challenge.
So Vollering...
Vollering, she could go to Movistar, she could go to UAE.
Come on, say Liva Lula. Do you want to hear that? Or is it a bit of a push?
That would be exciting. Imagine having her part of the Liva Lula team, the Australian outfit. That would be huge. They'd have to do some recruiting to build a team around her. But every other team would need... Any team that signs her would need to.
But they had Anamiek, so there's already that culture of Dutch rider performing, winners.
Van Vleuten having been there and done so much, as she did at Movistar as well. Wherever she goes, it will be a team that gets a big increase in their budget to be able to pay her what she deserves, and to bring a couple of riders across with her.
Yeah.
Why not Visma Lisa Bike?
Yeah.
Because she is the greatest of all time, but I think that's where she'll end up. Visma Lisa Bike, now that I think about it, Voss is past her best. She's still one of the best, but she's slightly past her best. Everybody, age catches up with everybody, no matter how great they are. And for the big Dutch team to sign Demi Vollering, it's a logical place for her to go.
Yeah, let's watch this space. Let's question on this race as well on the female side. Australian chances, we've got Grace Brown. There's Tiff Cromwell riding. There's, of course, Baker. There's Roseman Gannon.
Ruby Roseman Gannon's riding. Yeah. This is a race that suits Ruby Roseman Gannon. Of the Spring Classics, this is the one that she can perform in really well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And Josie Talbot's in it as well for the Cofidis team.
Yeah, on Amber Pate.
Yeah, Amber Pate, yeah. This race suits her too.
Yeah. There's some really good chance, so it's a good race to follow. For the men, what do you see happening?
I want to see how Christophe Laporte goes again as the outright team leader. This is going to be another one of those moments where we saw him at Milan-San Remo, as we just spoke about, where It was challenging for him to be the number one guy. So it didn't all go.
He's got Tish Benoit with him as well.
Well, that's pretty handy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that is handy. So I'm looking forward to seeing how he performs. And Tudor, the Swiss team, they're in the race. Matteo Trentin, you know, I like the idea of the way Matteo Trentin's been. I like the way he goes about it generally. And he's been pretty good so far at the start of the season.
And we said Van der Poel is going to be here. Cavendish is going to be here. He's on the start list. What do you make of this?
I'm not expecting a big result from Mark Cavendish in this one, to be perfectly frank. And for Mark Cavendish, the whole season is built around stage three of the Tour de France. that is the one. So Van der Poel and Philipsen, again, obviously, you know, Philipsen is probably the favourite on this course. It suits him. Benny Goumet is ridden a race before and won the race before. Tim Merlier will be super motivated, leading Soudal Quick-Step. Looking a little bit further down the list, Arnaud Demare is just not delivering so far, Christophe.
Nah, no, you know what I think of him.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I couldn't care less, to be honest,
if I'm
honest.
Yeah, Mohoric again for Bahrain victorious.
But the question around Matthews, can he do anything? Can he have his revenge here? Is it something that would be in his mind, finishing second at Milan-San Remo, could give him the extra oomph this weekend or not?
I'm hoping for the following weekend for Michael Matthews.
Okay, Flanders.
Yeah, Flanders. Again, if it can, Michael. There's hardly a race on the planet that Michael Matthews can't win that's of this nature. And in my view, he's one of the favourites for gold medal at the Olympic Games.
Yeah,
as well. That course really suits him, and he proved on the weekend with that second place finish that he can absolutely do it at the Olympics. The course suits him. Yeah, that's a bit more of a raffle, the Olympics, because the teams are so small, so it's really hard to control. And yeah, the biggest win for Matthews that he could possibly get this year is the Olympics. But for me, over the next fortnight, Tour of Flanders is a bigger target for Michael Matthews than Gent-Wevelgem.
Okay, and the last item on my list, Laura Kenny is retiring from professional cycling, let's call it. I couldn't find a better word, but just ahead of the Paris Olympics, a bit of a shame or not? Or does she know it's now time to hang the bike up, because maybe it would be the Olympics too far? She's done an amazing success in the Olympics for Team GB, but do you think the timing of this one, is it due to maybe her failing to raise her performance to a winning level, so she'd rather hang the bike up on a high rather than on a low?
And she's doing it on her terms. So she's won 5 Olympic Games gold medals.
Yeah, just five.
That dates back to London. She won the Omnium in London in 2012. So you're 12 years on. And I've heard a theory, which is a pretty good theory, that most elite athletes, they've got around about an 8-year window where they can perform at their best. And there's a few exceptions. You know, Mark Cavendish is one of those exceptions. And for Laura Kenny, or Trot, as she was formerly known before she got married to Jason Kenny, between them, they've got 7 Olympic gold medals.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He's got 7, she's got 5. And they've both been knighted. Oh, what a household. And, you know, she's 2 times a mother. She had a miscarriage to deal with as well. She's had a lot going on outside of cycling. And there's nothing that she needs to prove. She's won the Madison at the Olympics as well, which is a massive victory, team's pursuit. She's got nothing left to prove.
So at that stage, when you know, basically.
Yeah, and sometimes the body says no. Yeah. The computer says no?
Yeah, computer says no.
Sometimes the body says no, and you know, she can retire pretty darn content. I've lost count. I can't remember how many world titles she's won. I think it's more than her Olympic gold medals, a few Commonwealth Games gold medals as well. She's had an incredible career.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kinu, for joining us today.
Thanks, Christophe.